Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting the next interview in this continuing series with Maria Clavé, a pioneering world-renowned computer scientist and executive leader. Now, Maria, it's been a while since we talked, and you have so many more notable contributions, and I know your schedule is really tight, so thank you for sharing so much of your expertise and insights with our audience.
Well, I love talking with you, Stephen, and it's fun doing this series of interviews. I think we've been doing them for about 9 years now, and it helps me reflect on what's happened every time we do another interview.
Well, Maria, you know, our last full interview was a few years ago, and a lot has happened since, so let's mine into that, just kind of drill in. So what is new at Harvey Mudd, and what's the value?
Well, back in 2012, I think we had done lots of exciting things at Harvey Mudd, but I think the thing that was getting the most publicity was the progress we had made in reaching a better gender balance in our student body. We were, at that point, we were about between 46 and 47% female overall, and those female students were well distributed among different majors. And in particular, we managed to go from being about 10% female in our CS major back in 2012 to being 40%. Now, I'm happy to say that we've stayed around 40% in our CS major, and we're currently up about 44%, and our sophomore class is 47% in our CS major, so that has been something that that we've managed to sustain. But the thing that's really exciting is that we have managed to attract many more Black students, Hispanic students, Native American students, Pacific Islander students to the college. And this change has just happened over the last three incoming classes. In the class that will arrive in a couple of weeks, we are 13% Black, 22% Hispanic, and 3.5% Native American and Pacific Islander. So we are actually at or above the demographics for the United States in our incoming students. And this has been something the entire community has worked really hard on. And we're extremely excited about it. And we're also nervous because it's a very different experience for our faculty and our student body to have such racial and ethnic diversity. And I think one of the things you learn is we certainly learned this with the increasing number of women as students. The culture of your institution really needs to adapt to make sure that you're being as inclusive and supportive to the students you're not used to having with you as the ones that are sort of your traditional students. So that's a big deal. Another thing, and that we're really happy about, is Harvey Mudd has become much better known. And it's partly because of, things like the PayScale reports that have ranked Harvey Mudd, I think it's either 3 or 4 years in a row now, number one on return on investment. We'd be number one on early career salaries and mid-career salaries for, I think it's 2 years now. And it's definitely, and that plus all of the recognition for the things that we've been doing with women in areas like computer science and engineering, where they're typically underrepresented, has gotten us just tons of publicity. And, publicity's nice, but the reason it actually matters is that the whole purpose of what we're trying to do at Harvey Mudd is to innovate in science and engineering undergraduate education and demonstrate that it really is possible to have an outstanding, rigorous educational institution that is fully reflective in terms of diversity of, our demographic population. So, and the thing is that even if you achieve that, but nobody knows you achieve it, nobody's going to copy the things that you've done to make that possible. And of course, we're not trying to just change Harvey Mudd; we're trying to change the world of science and engineering education. And by being better known, it means that everything that we do has greater impact. Now, the third thing I want to mention is when I first arrived at Harvey Mudd, they had wonderful students, they had wonderful faculty, they had a wonderful educational program, just great things going on in general in the college. But the one part of the Harvey Mudd experience that I found sort of really not in line with the level of excellence that was there was what was actually going on and with our people was that our space was generally dingy and dismal would be the words I would use to describe it. Now, of course, that's not true of every single space, but there was the general sort of feeling was many of our classrooms were sort of dark, they were old-fashioned, they were very inflexible in terms of the kinds of new pedagogy that our faculty wanted to use. And so 2 years ago, we opened the Shanahan Teaching and Learning Center, which is this extraordinary building. We took down our first classroom building that was 9,000 square feet, and we've replaced it with this just amazing building that is light, bright, beautiful, and incredibly flexible and supportive of pedagogical innovation. It also houses the math department, admission and financial aid, and the president's office, as well as a few other things. And it's where the vast majority of our teaching goes on now, which means that we're bringing the entire community together into this building. It also has a Starbucks cafe, which is, has become a hub for everyone to get together. And the total square footage indoors in this building is about 72,000 square feet. But if you include all of the outdoor space, of which there's just tons, it's about 95,000 square feet. So it's become just the hub of the center of the campus. I mean, I've never in my academic life have experienced seeing an entire campus have the culture change so dramatically with just the addition of one building. But of course what that did was it meant that it made the other spaces look even drabber in comparison. And so we've been on a program of renovating all of our academic space, and we're not done yet. We've got probably another 5 to 7 years to go. But it's been exciting to see many of our existing buildings also become light, bright, and beautiful, as well as highly functional. And we're now starting the same kind of change in a residential space. We will be opening a new, the Drinkward, residence hall, in about 2 weeks, and when our new students arrive. And again, it is just, it's a quantum step upwards in terms of the quality of the space. So I remember having Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer, not at the same time, visit me in my old office. And I could just sort of see, which was dark and small and, had very few windows and, it was in a very dingy building. And I could sort of see them looking and sort of like, this really is Harvey Mudd? This is where the president of Harvey Mudd is? And now I have this phenomenal office in the Shanahan Center that looks out on the mountains and is just, I could very happily have any billionaire come and visit me in this office. So the space thing has been a big deal. And I think some people were very skeptical that changing how the space felt would have any impact on the learning environment. But it has a huge impact on prospective students, on our current students and faculty, prospective faculty, because it makes clear our commitment to, we're all about our students, we're all about learning. And by making our learning environment so beautiful, it has, and not particularly expensively beautiful, I want to point out, just beautiful, it's made a huge difference. And then the final one I want to mention is that we are in our first public fundraising campaign in 20 years. We launched the public phase of the campaign beginning of February 1 year ago. So we have just, we're in the middle of our second year and it's going really well.
Wow, that's a lot of significant contributions in terms of the evolution of Harvey Mudd.
And yeah, it's been a good 3 years.
So what are your goals for Harvey Mudd in the next 5 years?
So one of the things that I didn't mention that also happened, and I will mention it when we talk about, you know, what were the greatest challenges over the last 3 years, was we also, as part of all this, decided just before we entered the public phase of the campaign, we had been through a lot of discussions over the previous essentially year and a half about increasing the size of our student body. Now, we are very small. We are at about 800 students, and the plan was to increase the student body to 900, from 800 to 900 over a period of 10 years. Now, most places you wouldn't think that that was a big controversy, but it was, because one of the things we pride ourselves on, we talk about the magic of Harvey Mudd, and there's this worry that maybe there's some number that, you know, 845, that if we go past it, we lose the magic. So we spend a lot of time studying that. And so that's also one of the, so one of the, you know, number one things we want to happen in the next 5 years is that we are successful in this gradual growth. We are committed to putting resources, to having them available before the additional students arrive, hence the new dorm, and also, you know, the Shanahan Center and everything else. So that's one thing, is to make sure that we do the growth very carefully and make sure that we don't lose the magic of Harvey Mudd. So the second one is this, you know, we are ready, you know, for the entire 60 years of our existence, our focus has been on innovation and excellence in undergraduate science and engineering education. It's our goal to be constantly seeking to be better, to be evaluating the new things we've been doing, to be sharing the ones that turn out to be successful. But the piece that I think we are focusing on, particularly in the next 5 years, is to show that we can do that while also creating an incredibly inclusive environment, and one in which absolutely everyone, you know, whether they have a disability or, you know, are a person of color or are gay or transgender or whatever, that if they bring the interest and ability and commitment to hard work that makes for success at Harvey Mudd, that they will thrive. And so, you know, I would say for the next 5 years, it's certainly our big focus this year with our incredibly diverse entering first-year class, this whole idea of a focus on excellence and inclusion. So the second thing that we've just really started in the last year in a sort of a coordinated, visible way, is to collaborate with other institutions to share and disseminate successful practices. And the first big initiative along these lines is called BRAID. It stands for Building, Recruiting, and Inclusion for Diversity. And it's a collaboration with 15 computer science departments where the chairs of their departments committed that they were willing to work on at least three of the four best practices that have shown success at a number of other institutions. So the four practices are, number one, make your introductory course incredibly engaging, interesting, and not intimidating. Number two is to build confidence and community among underrepresented groups, so women, students of color. That's number two. Number three is outreach to high school teachers and students to attract more of the students entering college to think about computer science, particularly among the groups who are underrepresented in computer science. And number four is developing and promoting joint majors or double majors between areas like psychology or business or biology, where there are lots of women majoring, and by doing a double major, increase access to those students to learning computer science. So we have 15 departments that signed up for this. We have six departments, including Mudd, that have agreed to be beacon schools, and these are schools that have already managed to significantly increase the diversity of the students in their CS major, virtually all along the dimension of gender, and those are MIT, Carnegie Mellon, the University of Washington, the University of British Columbia, Cal Poly SLO, San Luis Obispo, plus Harvey Mudd. So those are the Beacon schools. And then as we started this project, we have ended up getting, I think we're at about five departments that want to be affiliates, so because they would like to try the same kinds of things. So this project came out of a talk that I gave at the Snowbird Conference which is a conference run by the Computing Research Association in Snowbird, Utah, every 2 years for focusing on computer science, chairs of computer science departments, mostly in the United States and Canada. And I had given a talk outlining the advances that the six departments that I named as Beacon departments had made in increasing gender diversity in their CS major. And so this was a 1.5-hour plenary, and towards the end, I had not planned on doing this, but, you know, I was thinking, you know, here we have all these leaders in computer science, and if we could have a bunch of them sign up that they want to work on changing their department along these similar lines, we could actually demonstrate that can be done anywhere if you're just willing to put in the effort. And so I said, you know, for the first 10 department chairs who say that they want to, you know, work on this, I will try to get you funding to send your students and faculty to the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. And before I finished my talk, I already had 15 departments who had signed up. And they all did it basically at the same time. And they all did it on their cell phones in the lecture. And so I decided I had to work with all 15 of them. And because I had done this, you know, just on the spur of the moment, then I had to, the next couple of days, I reached out to folks at Facebook, Google, and Microsoft, and then eventually also Intel, and asked them to provide funding for a 3-year period to enable this to happen. And, you know, this is sort of one of these, it was my summer project last summer, and one of the, Brad Smith, who's the senior VP for legal affairs at Microsoft, suggested to me that we should actually take some of the funding and use it to do a research project around this to study what actually happens in the departments. And so I recruited Linda Sachs from UCLA to lead this and research project. And, you know, it has... The four big tech companies agreed to support this, and so we've just completed the first year of the BRAVE project. That's actually not quite right because, you know, August last summer was assembling, you know, was a whole bit about getting the commitments from the companies and assembling the research team to study it and, you know, we eventually decided it would be a joint project with the Anita Borg Institute, so it's co-led by myself and Telly Whitney. And so we're actually not quite at the end of the first year, but we had our first BRAID summit where we brought together representatives from all of the participating departments as well as the affiliates and the Beacon schools and our funders and ABI. And we eventually pulled in NCWIT because they have a lot of really useful resources that can be used, that departments can use. And so we had a representative from NCWIT. So it was just... it was amazing. So I'm really hopeful that we're going to demonstrate that with relative, the departments are only receiving $30,000 a year, so it's not a large chunk of money, and they're doing a ton of work. But I want to demonstrate that it's possible for, you know, a wide variety of kinds of departments, and mostly public universities. Some of them are huge, like Arizona State. Some of them are much smaller, like the Missouri University of Science and Technology. But, you know, just to show that if you put the effort in and if you have leaders who are, are really committed to this, that things can change. So that's our first, you know, I hope that we will do similar kinds of things. Well, we already had run for many years a design workshop, which is brings together institutions that are emphasizing design in their engineering program. And So that's probably actually the first formal collaboration like this. But I'm sort of hoping that we're going to be able to do similar kinds of things across many areas of science and engineering, where we take things that society would like to see improve, and then we collectively work together on it. So that's the third goal. The fourth is, and this is, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life, I think, continuing to raise our visibility and reputation. And it's all about, it's not particularly because we want to be famous. It's because we really want to have the culture change in science and engineering. And if we're going to be, able to be a significant player in moving that forward, we have to have people know that we exist. So I've often said, it's probably in an earlier interview a number of times, I've often said that, before I finish as president of Harvey Mudd, I want everyone who's ever heard of MIT and Caltech to know about Harvey Mudd, because our role in terms of the education, undergraduate educational aspects of science and engineering are equally important as the roles that are played by MIT and Caltech in fundamental research in science and engineering. And the final one is, of course, to raise the necessary financial resources to enable all of the above. And that's, of course, why we're doing our campaign. It's why, I'm constantly looking for people who are really passionate about improving education in science and engineering and trying to get them involved with Harvey Mudd so that they can see that, they can really make a difference.
You know, that's just a fascinating, the goals that you're putting together and you're leading. And, there is this worldwide recognition of the leadership being demonstrated by your school, but also by yourself.
In a nutshell, then, why should foundations, institutes, individuals, and so on provide funding and support for Harvey Mudd?
Well, I think, first of all, they should do it because of, what we're actually doing. And, I think one of the things we've done from our very start is to lead the way in creating outstanding educational innovations that combine the strengths of a liberal arts approach with broad, deep, and rigorous science and engineering. So that's sort of, that's our calling card. That's what our mandate was when we were founded, and we have not strayed from it at all. We also, I think, were really the first science and engineering institution to emphasize experiential and interdisciplinary education. And, our clinic program in which teams of students work for an academic year on a problem for a company or a national lab or NASA or whatever celebrated 50 years. And it's has been copied in all kinds of places. And so, and there's lots of evidence that shows that hands-on learning is particularly in the early years, is particularly good at encouraging underrepresented groups to get involved in science and engineering, and also for retention. And I think today nobody would question the fact that interdisciplinary education is really important, because all of the most important challenges facing the world are not going to be solved by a single area of science or engineering. They're all going to be interdisciplinary, and many of them are going to involve the social sciences, like economics or sociology, psychology, because there's a cultural aspect of many of the issues that we're facing today. And so you really want people who can, you want graduates who are skilled and knowledgeable about working across different disciplines. And so, again, we're probably the first place to really place a huge emphasis on that. As I've already mentioned, if you care about diversity in tech workforce, you should be investing in Harvey Mudd, because it's not just what we're doing with our own graduates, who are amazing. And, I keep on having people, hire one and then say, do you have more? And it's just amazing how people compete for our graduates. But it's not just that. It's our efforts. It's our commitment to sharing whatever we discover with as many other institutions that want to collaborate. And then the final reason is that any donation you make to Harvard Mudd, whether it's $1,000 or $100 million, it has so much more impact here than it would at any of our competitors because we are so small, and also because we don't waste money. We are really good at efficiently using resources to make change. So, I think, clearly if your passion is, autism, or, we are not the place to give your money to because that's not what we do. But if you really care about, some of the things I've talked about, but, the general idea of educating scientists and engineers so they are really ready to go out and do outstanding work addressing the challenges that face the world, you should be giving to Harvey Mudd.
You know, Maria, you've been on this incredible journey, and I did interview you when you were dean, I guess, at Princeton.
Did you? I had forgotten that.
And then right after that, you got your position at Harvey Mudd, and I remember you just got the president's position, and there's a difference between being a dean and a president, and then there's a difference between being a president after many years, and your stature has risen considerably. You always were famous, but you've even had greater impact now. So can you share maybe the insights that you gained compared to when you were a dean versus being initially a president and now where you currently stand? And do you think when you look back, gee, maybe I was a little bit naive when I was a dean or when...
I've always been naive. I think one of the reasons that I've been successful is that essentially I take on the next position with enormous idealism about what's possible. And I always believe that what people say when they're trying to recruit you about how much they want to change and their aspirations for greatness and all this kind of stuff, and I arrive expecting to do exactly those things. And then, of course, you take on the role and you find out that there are a whole bunch of reasons why it hasn't happened already, that there's cultural reasons, there's political reasons, there's resource reasons, that had made it, and that, and you find out that you're not the first person to have taken this on with, grand idealism, and then discover that it's really, really hard. So, my typical sort of path is, take on one of these roles, things go wonderfully for the first, maybe 12 months, and then when I find out that, in fact, whoever the powers that be aren't as enthusiastic about change as they thought they were, because they often think you can achieve these changes without, sort of like, you're not going to change any of the inputs, but you expect that the outputs are going to change. And so, typically there's a period of where I ruffle a bunch of feathers because they're so going like, we didn't think we signed up for all this. And then there's a period of time when I sort of do a bunch of changes in my own approaches to smooth things, because what I'm realizing is that, being very bold and aggressive about making these changes is not going to get me anywhere, and find a way to sort of reset things so that we're building more consensus among the community about where we're going. And then eventually we achieve success. So, it's really not that much different from Princeton to Mudd or when I arrived as head of the CS department at UBC. It's all about, having this intense belief that it's possible to do these things without really understanding what the constraints are and how hard it's going to be. And then just being willing to work really, really hard, but also to do a lot of personal changes in order to find an approach that is going to genuinely work for the institution that you're at. So, I'm really naive. I'm beginning to gradually understand that actually naivety is about taking on these kinds of things is an asset, because you believe you can do more than most people would do because you're so idealistic. And then if that was all there was, then I would just, you know, flame out time and time again. And a big part of the success is finding a way to adjust the approach, the strategy, the style of what one does in order to legitimately achieve things in a way that the culture of the institution can embrace.
Now we're going to shift a little bit in a slightly different direction. Earlier this year, you supported something called YouSpark Live, and you gave some amazing words of advice. And I was able to share that with the audience and even write about it. And it so empowered people. People were really impassioned by what you gave to them. And I had a lot of people come up and say, wow, she's willing to share those kinds of things that will change me and my future and my family and so on. So do you have any advice updates from those words that you shared?
Well, of course, the problem is I can't remember what I said. What I tend to do with advice is I tend to try to focus on things that I think are counter to common myths. So, for example, one thing I often tell people is take the time, and I probably did this in the advice that I gave for YouSpark Live, take the time to learn something that's really difficult for you. And, you know, and that's advice that I've been giving for probably 20 years at this point. And it's all because we tend to, as a society, at least in North America, and I think it's probably less true in some countries in Asia, we tend to sort of classify, we tend to believe that people are born to be naturally good at something. And if there's something that is difficult for you to learn, that you just don't have whatever, you know, the genetic makeup or, I don't know, intellectual passions or something to be good at it. And it's completely nonsense. I mean, it's Carol Dweck has done this wonderful work on the growth mindset at Stanford, as well as, you know, she and several others have worked on stereotype threat and other kinds of things. And so one of the things that I think about that particular piece of advice is, first of all, if you're have any interest in being a teacher, taking the time to really learn and observe what you go through and trying to learn something that's very difficult for you to learn makes you understand so much better what the students who are struggling are going through, and, you know, gives you, you know, much better strategies for how you could actually help them. But it also, it gives you a confidence about, you know, different directions you could take with your career, about, you know, just what it gives you access to the whole world around you, rather than being sort of limited by saying, okay, well, I'm a math and art person, and, you know, I'm not very good at balance, I'm not very good at physical coordination, and therefore, you know, I'm going to do this set of things and not this other set of things. And so that's probably one of the pieces of advice that I gave. I also, and this one came a bit, well, I first thought about this when I was about, you know, probably 32 or so. So, which is half of my current age. I'm now 64, which is a very, very good age for a mathematician, computer scientist. And one of the things, I think when I was growing up, I thought pretty seriously that, I mean, I really believed in the natural ability thing, and that, you know, you were going to, the amount of impact you had on the world depended on how, you know, gifted you were. And because I thought I was really gifted at the time, you know, that was a good attitude for me to have. Of course, it was nonsense, but, and around, in my early 30s, by just watching who was being successful around me, I realized that natural ability had almost nothing to do with it. It was the people who were having a huge impact were the people who were choosing to set ambitious goals for what they wanted to achieve. So I think one of the things that's been really helpful for me is, you know, to be explicit about what I want to achieve, and not to be afraid to think big. And, you know, I think I've already told the story of my daughter saying when she was 17 or 18 that what I worked on wasn't important, because it changing the culture of science and engineering so that it was more supportive for women. that wasn't solving a major problem in the world. She was going to work on poverty, peace, and so on and so forth in the developing world. And I went like, yeah, Sasha, you go, girl. And she is. So, you know, I think this idea of not being afraid to say, I want to work on changing the world is important. I don't know if I said this one, but one of the things I think is really important, even as a young person, is to learn how to mentor others, because you learn a lot from helping others. And of course, it makes it more likely that people will help you, but I think it's more, you know, having a great life is really about always learning and you know, pushing yourself to learn more, even the things that are painful to learn. And I think mentoring others is one of the great approaches. One that I learned really late, and I'm now trying to persuade many MUD students and others to learn it a lot earlier than I did, is to learn how to ask for help. And I think one of the things about being, you know, somebody who's not part of the dominant group is that you don't want to ask for help because you don't want to admit that you might need help. And because you don't feel like you belong, you are absolutely determined to get there, to succeed on your own. And also, because you've had lots of advice throughout your life that, you know, girls don't do this, women don't do this, black people don't do this, black people aren't good at this, whatever, you don't really trust advice you might get. So you just don't ask. And if somebody gives you advice, you deliberately ignore it. And I would say it's probably in the last dozen years that I've really gotten a lot better at both asking for help and listening to advice that people give me and taking it seriously. And then my final one that I probably said at Youth Spark Live is persistence and hard work is so much more important than natural ability or really anything else, because you know, I've seen so many times that somebody was getting close to something and then they had a setback, and if they persevere through it, they come out at even further ahead than they would have without the setback. And if they let the setback cause them to give up, they come out so much worse than they would have if they persisted. So, and then, you know, I'm a very big believer. I don't think you should be working hard all the time, but I think really working hard a good chunk of the time is actually very beneficial.
Yeah, it's great advice that you're giving, and that it's good that there's additions to the ones that you provided before, and really very natural extensions to the one you provided for. It'd be interesting to see, in terms of your own personal goals, where do you want to go now, or what do you want to accomplish now?
So, this big charge that I've been on for, you know, a very long time is increasing the recognition worldwide of the importance of creating truly inclusive learning and work environments. But it's funny, I was talking to my high school friend Lisa, and who shares this passion, who's also a computer scientist, and she was saying, you know, it's really all about getting rid of arrogance. And she is so right. I mean, arrogance is the root of so much of the things, and often it's people don't even realize the arrogance at all, but it's the root of so many of the things that make the outsiders feel like outsiders and, you know, makes them doubt their ability and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So I started out with a focus on the issues around gender. Now I'm realizing that it really doesn't matter whether it's gender or race or having a disability or looking differently or having a different sexual orientation or growing up on a farm and not, you know, having exposure to lots of different kinds of things. It's just we really should be focusing on how we make educational environments, learning environments, and making work environments ones where everyone can thrive. Because when you do that, you get way better outcomes for everyone. I mean, it's not like you're, you know, benefiting females and, you know, somehow, you know, hurting males, what we've discovered at Mudd is every time we try to make something better for, you know, when we discover something that is holding back, you know, some group of students, it makes it better for absolutely everyone. So, so that's the first one. The second one is one that that I'm really going to give a shot at, but I'm sort of scared of and doubtful about, which is to write a book about why today's undergraduates deserve an education like the one offered by Harvey Mudd. And obviously I'm not saying everybody should go to Harvey Mudd, but what I'm saying is that for success in, you know, today's world, it's really great to have a broad and deep education that spreads across science, engineering, humanities, and social sciences and the arts. And that, you know, learning that plus learning communication skills, learning teamwork skills, all of these things pretty much everyone needs. Or at least you're going to do better if you can get a great education like that. So, and of course, I'm planning on sort of motivating it with, you know, stories from my own experiences. So that's the plan. The reason I feel so intimidated by it is that I'm such a slow writer, and, you know, just the number of hours it's going to take to do this. But I've decided that, I reach a lot of people by giving talks, which is really easy for me, and I love giving them. But there are people that would be reached if I were actually to write a book about these ideas that won't be reached by hearing me give a talk. So anyway, that's number two. The third one is to continue to learn and grow as an artist. And, you know, I feel just unbelievably lucky to, to be able to be a president of an amazing place like Harvey Mudd and, you know, participate in lots of other interesting sort of work-related things and yet have time to commit to working on my artwork. So I'm, and, you know, as I think I probably told you before, one of the ways I do that is I tend to be painting when I'm doing mentoring calls with mostly women but also men all across the country and occasionally in, well, certainly all across North America and occasionally in other countries as well. And it's sort of a way for me to feel, okay, it makes me feel, you know, like relaxed about spending an hour with somebody on the phone because that's an hour that I'm painting. And it also makes me feel relaxed about spending an hour painting because that's an hour that I'm spending on the phone. So so that's the third one. The fourth one, which you have a role in, is to give a TED Talk. And I have committed to that I will give a TED Talk at TEDx in LA in December of this year. And the focus is going to be on imagining what it would be like to be in a truly inclusive world. And then my last one is to spend lots of time with my family and friends. And I think one of the things I'm getting better about is to recognize that I've had a lot of illness in the last year, which I'll talk about maybe a little bit later, and I tend to think of myself with boundless energy, and, you know, I can work as hard as I want for as long as I want, and I'll be okay, and I had an experience this last year that taught me that that wasn't true, and I think one of the things I'm recognizing is I just have to do a better job of making sure I've got downtime, whether it's painting or just being with friends, being with my kids, particularly spending time with my husband, that I need to do enough of that in order to be able to handle the sort of energy requirements of when, I'm taking on these other kinds of challenges. So those are my five goals.
You know, it's interesting on the TED Talk. I was talking to Amir, and he says you're going to involve your school in some way, or?
Yeah. So, so Amir, as you know, has this dream that the people giving the TED Talks will they'll also have some kind of project going on that helps in some small way enable, at least for a short period of time, the whatever the dream is. And of course, my dream is this idea of a truly inclusive world. And so my cabinet and I, so my cabinet is my vice presidents and a couple of other people like Karen, the director of the president's office, we typically set a couple of goals for the coming year collectively, and then we set individual goals. And both on my individual goal list and on the cabinet thing is this focus on excellence and inclusion for this coming year. And so one of the things I'm going to be doing is having a meal, lunch or dinner, with all of our incoming class of 215 students in groups of, let's say, around 10, and talking to them. I mean, one of the things I'm really focusing on is, you know, how to get support when you face difficulty, and this idea of being able to ask for help. And so I'm going to do as many as I can in the fall semester. I'll probably have some that get left to the spring semester. And one of the things I want to do as part of this is have a dialogue with students about what inclusion means to them. And I'm going to bring a faculty member with me to each one of these meals. And so so we're doing this whole focus on inclusion and excellence for this year, and that's also the focus of my talk. So I'm excited about it.
Oh, that's amazing. And I guess it requires, like you're bringing in a community, in essence, and that community will spread, I guess, virally.
Yeah. And it wouldn't be happening without you, because initially when Amir, you know, told me that, you know, he wanted each of the people who spoke to have a project, and I was sort of like going, I couldn't figure out what should be our project. And then when we found out about our incoming class and we started talking about how we really, you know, how we really want to focus on creating a culture that is truly inclusive at Harvey Mudd, then it became clear. And I'm going to be working with, so we have two associate deans for diversity, Sumi Pandekur on the student side and Daryl Yong on the faculty side, and they're going to be working with me on this project and working with me on my TED Talk. And it was funny, Amir was saying, you know that he was going to want to have, you know, phone calls regularly about this, to make sure that I was really working on my talk. And I said, Amir, you just don't understand how we work at Harvey Mudd. We're taking this on, and that means that we're going to be working on it pretty much every week. So I'm excited.
Well, it will be. I can't wait. It'll be just amazing. Now, Maria, since we last talked, you've had some outstanding recognitions worldwide for the impact you've had, the ability for you to shape the world, and so on. Can you just describe some of these recognitions? And the reason is it provides you're an inspiration, in essence, right? And a role model for, you know, millions out there. And these help to kind of define or shape some of that.
Well, the one that was by far the most surprising was last year. So Fortune magazine did their 50 greatest leaders list, and I was number 17 on the list, and I had no idea what was happening. And so so this came out a year ago, March 2014. And so I happened to be in Sun Valley, and I was doing an interview with the NPR station in New York City, and my laptop was open, and I was seeing something flash across the screen that said, number 17, greatest leader. I'm going like, what is this? And I finally, you know, finished the interview, and I go look, and I'm getting all these congratulatory messages from people. And so I go look at the list, and, you know, so there's, Angela Merkel, there's the Pope, there's the Dalai Lama, there's, you know, Bono. It's just like, and I'm number 17. Angelina Jolie is number 21. This is the first time in my life that my daughter was really proud of me, I have to say.
I mean, Tim Cook of Apple, I think, was 33rd or something. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was just bizarre. And when I went out to go skiing that day, when I got on the chairlift, there was some random person sitting beside me, and I said, you don't know this, but you're sitting beside the 17th greatest leader of the world. Like, it was just bizarre. And, you know, I understand that there are, so I understand a bunch of things about this. First of all, I know that the reason I was on the list was that they wanted to have somebody representing the issue about diversity in tech, and particularly women in the tech industry. So, and I'm sort of the poster kid for that in some sense. And I also know that, there were a variety of other awards. This year was really my big year. Well, last year I got the Women of Vision Leadership Award from the Ingeborg Institute, and which I was super happy about because both Anita Borg was one of my best friends and Kelly Whitney, who's the CEO of the Ingeborg Institute, was one of my best friends, and it was just lovely. But this year I got a bunch that I absolutely was not expecting. It was the AAUW Leadership Award, American Association of University Women. There was the induction into the U.S. News & World Report STEM Hall of Fame, together with from AAAS, just an amazing group of people. Stephen Bechtel from the Bechtel Corporation. Just absolutely extraordinary group of five individuals. And I was sort of like, wow, you know, why did they think of me? Why would they do this? So, you know, the thing, when I think about the stuff happening, I have a whole bunch of reactions. One of them is, obviously, I feel honored and grateful. The second immediate reaction is the imposter syndrome. I don't belong to be in whatever this group is. The third one is, a more, I think, reasonable response, which is, you know, I'm not really receiving this for my own work. I'm receiving it as the leader of Harvey Mudd College and also as a participant in a number of other projects where there's a whole community of people who are working to do extraordinary things, and I'm really receiving it on their behalf. And I'm not saying that I don't do anything. I mean, I do things. I have crazy ideas, and I try to bring them to life. But nothing you do as a leader is done by you. It's done by you in concert with, typically hundreds of people, certainly at Mudd, hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people. So, I often joke that when you're president of an institution, you get all the blame and all the credit. And so this is, I'm getting a lot of credit for things that a ton of people have done. Sometimes I'm directly involved, sometimes I'm not involved at all. But I'm getting the recognition on behalf of, of organizations and groups of people that do extraordinary things. So there are definitely consequences to this. So one of them is that it has greatly increase my network. It's much easier for me. I'll give you an example. So one of the people that I have wanted to meet for a while is Vinod Khosla. So he's the VC who funds a lot of companies that are working on things that are good for the world, sustainability, green energy, things like that. And I tried to arrange a meeting with him a couple of times when I went to the Bay Area, Palo Alto, and Silicon Valley, and, he was just never, he was never in town, which is not that surprising. And then I got an email from the editor at Forbes for the Education Channel and introducing me to somebody called Niru Khosla, and who is doing a lot of interesting things around STEM education in K-12. And so I noted that she had the same last name, but I didn't know if there were a relation. But anyhow, I said I'd be pleased to meet her. So then I was at the ASU-GSV Summit on Educational Technology, and Miru walked up to me and introduced herself. And I just happened to ask her if she was related to Vino. And she said, yeah, he's my husband for the last 35 years. And we were joking because my husband Nick and I have also been married 35 years. And then I said, you know, I've always wanted to meet him. And she says, oh, well, he's right here. And literally he was standing like a few feet away. And so I got to meet him. And, you know, it's just, there's a greater likelihood that somebody will be willing to meet with me because they're interested in the same kinds of things that I'm interested in, and they'll actually have heard of me. So one of the people I want to meet, because he's very interested in computer science in K-12, is Mike Bloomberg. And I was talking with Tom Secunda, who's been at Bloomberg since it was founded, and who's another generous philanthropist and somebody who's interested in STEM education. And I visit Tom, about once a year in New York City. And I was saying, Tom, next time I come, I'd love to meet Mike. And he said, of course. It will depend on the day and we'll have to work on those kinds of things, but I'm sure he'd love to meet you. So it's just, I'm a huge believer in the power of networking. And, you are part of my network because you are frequently introducing me to people and giving me opportunities to give talks and be involved in various kinds of things. And it has expanded that network greatly, which is just helpful in terms of the things I'm trying to achieve. And then the final one is that, this sounds sort of ridiculous, but people listen differently to your ideas, your suggestions, when you've received a lot of recognition. They expect your ideas to be more important and impactful than they would otherwise. And so it increases it leverages your ability to contribute to change in positive ways. And so for all of those reasons, this is going to sound so ridiculous, but I'm generally shortly before I'm receiving an award, I'm intensely depressed because I'm so sure I don't deserve it. And, usually Nick is with me and I'm going like, they're not going to like my talk. It's like, I get through, some period of time and then I go, I'm doing it, right? It's the imposter syndrome. He goes, yep. It's just, I just have realized that, one of the other things I've been talking about recently is, and so I talk about the imposter syndrome a lot, but I've come to the conclusion that having the imposter syndrome is actually a great benefit, even though it's very uncomfortable at times, because one, it decreases arrogance, and which is a good thing, and two, the fact that you're so self-critical actually means that you're more likely to improve and continue to improve your ability to be successful. So yeah, I'm really happy about the recognition. I'm embarrassed by it. It's weird.
I mean, it's just, I just love your stories and, the sort of interactions that you share is just wonderful. Now, this you probably can't share, but I'm going to ask it anyways because, Microsoft and Broadcom have been in the news quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you can share from your work with Microsoft and Broadcom since you are on the board at their invitation?
Yeah, so I think what would be appropriate to say is both are incredible learning experiences, and I feel so lucky to have those learning experiences. And I also feel in both cases that I am making a contribution, that I'm bringing a slightly different perspective and a different set of experiences, and I'm much less knowledgeable than many people on the board in some areas. But I think I can see things that maybe other people wouldn't be as likely to see just because I'm coming from a different world. In both cases, you know, lots of challenges and lots of opportunities. I have great confidence in the future of both. It's been it's really interesting to be part and participating in the transformation of Microsoft under Satya Nadella's leadership, which I'm it's just fascinating, and I'm really liking being there and being part of it. At Broadcom, obviously, there's a transaction underway, an acquisition by Avago. It's fascinating and highly complicated. But, you know, I think it, the direction it's going is really the best thing for the shareholders. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting as it plays out. There's obviously lots of antitrust stuff that has to be handled. There are lawsuits, as there always are in this kind of transaction. And, you know, it's just interesting. But, you know, in both cases, I feel like, so for Microsoft, I've been on the board for 6 and a bit years. In Broadcom, it's 4 years. And I feel like what I've learned from those experiences has been enormously helpful, you know, across all of the things I'm working on. And you know, I tend to think of, I like the opportunity to learn about the challenges and opportunities, and I like the opportunity to see inside the companies as things are happening. So I think that's about what I can say.
Now, you do have a lot of volunteer roles. Is there anything you'd like to share about them?
Well, I think the thing that's completely new since we last talked is Ed Reports. So this is something I've been working on for about 3 years. It came out of a retreat at the Annenberg Sunnyland Center in outside of Palm Springs. And this retreat was, the topic of the retreat had 23 attendees, and Bill Gates helped us set up and helped us, you know, bring in a number of the attendees. And it was about what are the barriers for the adoption of technology-enabled mathematics instruction in K-12. And so we had people like Sal Khan and Zoran Popovich from UW and Alex Kachatrian from Reasoning Mind. So, you know, a variety of people who were working on technology-enabled instructional resources and mathematics. We had Carol Dweck, and a variety of people from the math education community, and also from doing educational research around what barriers are in terms of pedagogy and so on. We had Bill Schmidt from the University of Michigan, as one of the leading people in things like TIMSS and PISA, the international comparisons of mathematical achievement. We had a couple of teachers. We had a couple of superintendents. It was just, and it was a very highly curated event in that we were looking for people who were sort of extremely knowledgeable in a discipline that had relevance for this particular topic, but also were good at listening, and would come to it with an open mind. And it was, I did research in this area for a number of years while I was at UBC. And I have a deep interest in technology-enabled education. And so I was, thrilled to do this. But, I've been to umpty-ump kinds of similar things where you bring together a variety of people with different experiences, and then you're hoping that they'll agree on something they could do collectively together. And the vast majority, are just frustration. I mean, you get nowhere. You're so frustrated that it seems like everyone has no idea, understanding, or appreciation for what the challenges are in somebody else's area of expertise. And this is completely different. It was one of the most interesting and stimulating experiences I've had. And at the end of the second day, there was unanimous agreement that the number one problem in terms of instructional materials, whether it's technology enabled or not, is that there's no nonpartisan group that actually evaluates them. And, you know, and so we had this idea of creating something like the consumer reports for instructional materials, focusing on starting with math, but and really focusing, because at that time we were seeing that the Common Core was going to be implemented. There were at that time 45 states who'd signed up for it. You know, it eventually became this political target of Republicans who claimed that it was a federal attempt to take away educational control from the states. And so we've had a few states back out of it, but I think there are at least 40 states who are still going forward with it. So we spent the next, really, almost 2 years after that, working on, maybe a little bit more than 2 years, working on a design for such an organization. And it was led by Robin Kramer, who was working with Sonny Lenz, and who's just an amazing person. I love working with her. I first met her, she was chair of the board at Pitzer College, which is right next to Harvey Mudd, as one of the Claremont colleges, but then really got to know her well through this process. And as we went along, it became clear that there were a number of foundations, in addition to the Gates Foundation, who really wanted to see this happen. So the founding funders turned out to be Hewlett Foundation and Helmsley and Gates. And there's an organization called Ed First that basically is sort of an incubator for educational projects and organizations. And so we worked with them to, you know, to sort of start the process, to hire an executive director, to get the initial set of reviews underway. And I had said all along that I would, that, you know, I would be involved with this project, and so I ended up being the founding chair of the board. We launched our first set of reviews for K through 8 instructional materials and mathematics in March. We have just done a review of our methodology for doing the reviews, and we're just, we've made some changes. We've said from the beginning that we're a learning organization, and so, you know, there'll be things we don't get right initially. We have a wonderful board, and it's been a wonderful experience. And it's one of these sort of dream things that, you know, about setting an ambitious goal and then working at it. And it's launched, and we're about to start reviews also of high school math materials and also of K through 8 English language arts. So, and, you know, completely different nonprofit kind of experience from, you know, what I've done with ACM or ABI or, you know, CRA and so on and so forth. But because I had spent 10 years working in this space and had done a lot of work with, you know, school superintendents and principals and actual teachers and stuff like that, it's just been a great experience. So anyway, that's the big new thing. I expect I'll probably chair the board for 3 years or something like that. I'm a big believer that when you create something, it's important not to stay as a leader for too long, because you don't want it to be your thing. You want it to be whatever that thing is. And so anyway, I'm very excited.
Well, that's an amazing piece of work that you're you know, putting forward, and with tangible results at the end of it. You know, you've had many challenging experiences from 2012. Are there any that you want to share and lessons that they provide?
Well, when I was thinking about this, there are definitely a few that I want to share. So the first one is that both in 2012, there were two deaths that were just painful, unbelievably painful for the Mudd community. So the first one was Malcolm Lewis, who's an alum, had been on our board for, I don't know, between 30 and 40 years, developed blood and was board, had become board chair, the first alum to chair the board, about towards the beginning of 2012. You know, within a month of his becoming board chair, he was diagnosed with bladder cancer, and he died in October. And, I mean, we loved this guy. I mean, I loved this guy. I found him amazing to work with, and it was just, you know, he was like 66 when he died. I mean, it's like, there's just nothing to say about it that's other than, you know, it's a huge loss and a loss for the world. He was one of the people that helped, and his profession was sustainable construction, sustainable development. He was one of the people that helped form the LEED certification of buildings. I mean, he was a leader, he was an innovator, and he was an extraordinarily kind, funny, warm, human, wonderful person. And I found that just hard, very hard. And I think everyone in our community found it really hard. I mean, it's just, it's hard to make sense of somebody wonderful dying at that age. But sure, I mean, we obviously knew that, you know, by, you know, July that he had a few more months to live. Also that summer in August, one of our rising juniors, student called Ben Huppy, was killed in a car accident at 7:30 a.m. in the morning. And it's just one of those things that is completely inexplicable. He was driving to a volunteer internship he had. We think that probably, you know, a deer crossed the road and he swerved to avoid it or something like that, but he hit a tree trunk and died instantly. And, you know, it's one of these, he was one of our student leaders. He was incredibly kind and generous and funny and hardworking and the only kid of his parents' only kid. He, you know, founded a society when he was a teenager in high school to recycle, you know, old computing equipment, send it to, you know, countries where they didn't have access. I mean, just to schools and countries where, you know, that where they didn't have any or very little, you know, PCs or whatever. I mean, just one of those people that makes the world a better place in their daily life. And he died at the age of 20. And, you know, so, you know, one of the things I think when these things happen are, you know, trying to think about ways that you can create something in their memory that is going to signify the wonderful people they were. And so in Malcolm's, so there's a number of things in Malcolm's memory, but one of them is chair in his name for a professor working on environmental issues, environmental policy issues, Paul Steinberg. And for Ben, we established volunteer summer internships in Ben's memory. One of the things I loved about the Mudd community is, you know, about 20 of his closest friends in after his death over the next couple of months visited and went and spent time, not to, you know, in small groups with his parents and talked about who Ben was and, you know, what he did at Mudd. And because, of course, they had, it's one of those things, your kid goes away to college and at least my kids, they don't tell you much about what's happening. And, you know, you don't get a lot of details. And so our students decided that they were going to share everything they could about why he was so special and the kinds of things he was doing. And every year, his parents, we do a celebration of our volunteer internships, community engagement internships, and his parents come back for that. And but it's just, I don't know, it's just hard. I mean, I know there every day there are people who are wonderful human beings dying where the community around them is just going, it makes no sense. But it certainly, those are the first two deaths like that in my experience as president Mudd. I mean, we also, in the summer of 2012, we lost the founding president, Joe Platt. But that was a situation where he was almost 97 years old. He had had the most amazing life. And you know, and was grateful, you know, I was felt great that I got to spend, you know, a fair amount of time with him in my first 5 years, and even time in his final year, visiting him at home and stuff like that. And so there's a huge difference between those losses. But I guess the good part would be that Harvey Mudd is a very tight community, and I think really came together to make the family members know how much we valued what the person they lost meant to us. But it was just hard. So that's one. The second one I already referred to a little bit, which was navigating the decision to grow Harvey Mudd to 900 students over 10 years. And what my board chair, Wayne Drinkard, would say is change is hard. And it is hard. And, you know, this growth reflects the same pace of growth that Harvey Mudd has been growing since it was founded. The difference is, unlike most other times, though not all other times, we decided to engage the community in discussing it and having them have a chance to think about it before the board discussed it, with the goal that then, you know, the faculty and students and alumni could inform the board about how they felt about it. And in spite of all that, in spite of spending, you know, about a year and a half discussing it before the board took a vote, it was when I actually, you know, the board had decided at the moment when they were supposed to decide that they asked the administration to create a plan for growth, and we did. And before taking it to the board at the September board meeting, I showed it to the faculty because I, you know, think it's appropriate. And somehow they had not really digested the fact that the board was moving forward with this, and all hell broke loose. And then the students heard about it from the faculty, and they got equally upset. And it was so frustrating for the people who had been, you know, working really hard to engage the faculty and students in discussions for many, many months, to have, you know, that just be completely disregarded. But in any case, the board handled it extraordinarily well. They, several trustees, probably about eight in total, came and spent a day, not the same day, so they would come one or two at a time, and listen to, meet with small groups of faculty and eventually with students as well, just listen to them, and then report back on what they had heard and share that with our community. And, you know, eventually the board voted unanimously in favor of the growth and also in favor of moving forward with the public campaign. And we just moved on. And it was an extraordinary experience. It was incredibly painful during, you know, about a few months period when there was suddenly all of this distrust and finger pointing and all kinds of things. And the board, you know, their willingness to come and listen and, you know, not argue, just listen and make it clear that they had heard every possible concern that people had, just calmed things down and we moved forward. So it was quite an experience. I mean, I'm a very big believer in consultation, listening, you know, making sure that people have an opportunity to be heard. And we had tried so hard the year that preceded all this happening, and then to have it just sort of blow up, it was really frustrating. But then to see it get calmed through leadership by board members, and particularly by the board chair and vice chair, was phenomenal. So anyway, big challenge, big success. You know, I have some ideas about how we would do the listening process differently, if we were doing it over again, because, you know, there are always things that aren't, that in retrospect you'd say, well, I do it this way rather than that way. But, yeah, it was interesting. And then the final one I'll mention, which I already mentioned, you know, like referred to, is a year ago, so March 2014, actually right around the time when I got this, you know, found out that I was on Fortune's Greatest Leader list, I was diagnosed with a tumor in my jawbone, and it wasn't, fortunately, malignant, but it was very fast-growing, and there are severe health consequences if you don't remove it, because you can get an infection that goes either into your heart or into your brain, both of which are not recommended. And so I had the surgery. So it turned out that I had the same tumor in the same place 25 years ago. And 25 years ago, I had it shortly after I arrived in Vancouver. And 25 years ago, the treatment was you just curate the tumor. So you basically dig out the tumor. And in the last 25 years, they have found that tumors can regenerate. And so now they take out a chunk of your jawbone that's about a centimeter away from the radius of the tumor. So for me, it was, I don't know, 3 centimeters by 3 centimeters. And because I'd had the curation surgery before, I wasn't really thinking it would be that bad. And it was definitely by far the most painful experience I've been through in my life. And it probably took me something like 2 months to recover from that surgery. And, of course, I had been told, you know, recovery should be like 2 weeks. And so I had 6 weeks when I was traveling around giving talks and doing all this stuff when I was still really under the weather. And then I had, in December, the next set surgery, which was to take a piece of my jawbone, a piece of my hip bone, and put it where the jawbone had been. And I picked up, at one of those two, an antibiotic surgeries, an antibiotic-resistant infection. I think it was actually at the first one because that was done in a hospital, which is hospitals are notorious for this kind of thing. But the bottom line was I had noticed that things like, you know, scratches on my body were not healing in the way that they used to heal. Like they might normally heal in a week and they would be there for 2 months and just not heal. And that's a sign of an antibiotic-resistant infection. But in any case, after I had this second surgery, the wound for that second surgery of my hip refused to heal, and I was on antibiotics for about, I think it was 5 different sets of antibiotics over a 4-month period before we finally got it knocked out. And so for that period of time, I was sort of course, I was still working, and I was needing to sleep 12 to 14 hours a day. It was like, it was, I think, one of the things that, you know, I've been extremely healthy most of my life, and it was a completely different experience to not have the same level of energy, you know, like your brain is foggy most of the time, all this kind of stuff, and so it was quite the year. And, there's a lot of things, you know. Obviously, everything could have turned out much worse. I could, you know, I was very lucky to get on a reasonably new and incredibly expensive antibiotic that eventually healed the infection, because I could have spent months on an IV and ended up in the hospital and all kinds of things. So, you know, I got off relatively easy. But there's nothing like going through this to make you appreciate being healthy. So I'm healthy. I'm happy. I'm relieved. And at the same time, one of our trustees was going through discovery of pancreatic cancer. And very fortunately, they were able to operate on it, and it was the type that is operable and can be treated. And so whenever I was feeling sorry for myself, I just thought about our trustee and thought, okay, what he's going through is so much worse than what I'm going through. This is nothing. And he's doing well, too, so I'm very grateful for that, too.
Well, and that's must be, you know, a daunting kind of challenge that, you know, all of the challenges that you mentioned, but especially the health one as well, right? Because that's the foundation of who you are and what you're able to do and the realization of your dreams or your goals. So I just... wholeheartedly wish you a safe and full
recovery. Yes, I do too. So, you know, I have to admit, you know, I've had a sister go through breast cancer. I've, you know, lost Anita Borg to brain cancer. I mean, I've had many good friends go through breast cancer, and I will say that what I went through was nothing compared to what I have seen others go through. So, you know, it certainly was hard. And it's a good reminder that, you know, you shouldn't take good health and energy and all those kinds of things for granted. But, you know, in the scheme of things, it was you know, epsilon compared to, you know, a really major thing. But it certainly didn't feel like epsilon at the time.
Now, we're going to sort of combine a number of questions, because I know that, you know, you have many delays in your time. I know your husband's probably waiting in the background saying, you know, when is he going to finish? So I'm going to combine these questions. And the reason is it really sort of revolves around yourself in terms of your attitude, your approach to family and friends. So this first part of this question is looking forward. How would you describe yourself in terms of friends, families, activities, hobbies, life in general, dreams, career? And related to that, what are some of the forces shaping you now? And then related to that, are there mentors who continue to shape you in some way or influence you?
So the first thing is, you know, as I just said, I'm really happy. I love my job. Every member of my family is, you know, like my husband and each of my children, they're in a really good space right now. And that's a wonderful thing. And not only do I love my job, I love, you know, all the other things I'm able to do, painting, skiing, kayaking, hiking, all of these kinds of things. So, you know, I feel very fortunate that I'm able to work on things that are really important to me, and I'm also spending time doing things that I love doing and that are a very good, balance complement to what I do in my work. I have agreed to stay at MUND for another 5-year contract after the current 5-year one I'm on ends. So that's actually another 6 years from now. And you know, it's partly because I love my job, but I feel we have an enormous amount of momentum right now. And it's not, the job's not done. I mean, you know, it's one thing to have recruited an amazingly diverse incoming class. It's another thing to demonstrate that we can really give them the same kind of educational opportunities as the students who were the norm at MUD, let's say 30 years ago. So lots left to do. But you know, the other thing is, MUD is a great platform for all the other things I'm doing in a couple of reasons. One is, it's incredibly, you know, there's a great coherence between what MUD wants to achieve and what I want to achieve. And so there's a great support from the college about, you know, the BRAID project, about Ed Reports, about, you know, my being on the boards of Microsoft and Broadcom and so on. And also, because it is so small, because I also have just an extraordinarily talented team of leaders helping lead the college, and amazing faculty and students and staff, as well as alumni, you know, I have more bandwidth to think about other things and to work on national and international initiatives than I would if I were, you know, president of Princeton or something like that. So I'm feeling enormously positive and happy at the moment. I've been getting up pretty much every day on Pender and saying to my husband, Nick, have I told you how happy I am? And he'll say, yeah, about a sentence ago. So in terms of things that are shaping things right now, you know, for me, time constraints, obviously, and because I'm getting many more opportunities to do things, and so I can't do all of them, and I have to, you know, set priorities and say no a lot more often. And, you know, one thing that's really nice is that a lot of the opportunities I get asked to do in terms of giving talks that I can't do, I can recommend somebody, you know, either one of our faculty members or one of our board members or somebody else that I know is a great speaker. And so, you know, I do feel like, you know, I feel really happy about, you know, some of the things I can't do but somebody else is taking on. And but just thinking about managing my schedule is, that's just a big force right now. And, you know, and along those lines, just making sure I spend enough time exercising and doing non-work things to remain healthy. So in my third semester at MUD, I might have mentioned this in a previous interview, I worked with an executive coach called Sabina Nawaz to try to make sure that some of the faculty were uncomfortable with my style, the level of energy, the level of disclosure, you know, they were used to having a much quieter president. And so I worked with Sabina to learn skills to be able to be more quiet with the faculty who really wanted that kind of leadership. And one of the things that Sabina had told me was, you know, we all have things that increase stress and reduce stress. And one of the things about being a president is you have to spend enough time on a regular basis doing the reduce stress things so that your stress level is low enough that if there's a crisis, you're going to be able to handle it without getting upset or, you know, angry or, you know, whatever. And so I'm very conscious about that. And, you know, and just because of the increased number of opportunities, many of which sound really attractive when they're first mentioned. And then, you know, when you're on planes every day of the week for several weeks in a row, you sort of go like, that was stupid. So, so making sure that I'm maintaining that balance. Obviously, it's huge focus on excellence and inclusion for me right now. We're also celebrating MUD's 60th anniversary this year, so we've got you know, events going on around the country and internationally as well to do that. And then there's this book that I claim I'm going to write. So, you know, that's a lot of stuff. And in terms of mentors, you know, I've always had my husband and each of my children as a confidant, somebody who provides advice, somebody who just they're great sounding boards. They're enormously supportive. So, you know, that hasn't changed. It's just gotten better. And I also lean very heavily on my cabinet, so my vice presidents and a couple of other people. And we meet, if I'm in town, for 2 or 3 hours a week, every week. And I make no decisions about anything without consulting them first. And they're amazing, both as individuals and as a group. But the one that I probably wouldn't have said in 2012, because it wasn't true at that point, was so after Malcolm died, another alum, Wayne Drickard, class of 73, took over as board chair. And Barbara Patoka, who's a parent of a student graduated, I believe, in 2000, who had been vice chair of the board, and Wayne and I started doing phone calls, sometimes weekly and sometimes every 2 weeks. And over the 3 years we've been doing this, I have one tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., they have become just amazing mentors to me. And, you know, it takes a while to, you know, build up the relationship where you can share not just the typical issues that are issues affecting a college, but they share some of your doubts, some of your concerns, and get ideas from them. And we have become, I think, just an extraordinary trio. And they are just so good at giving me feedback. And sometimes the feedback is, okay, well, let's sort of like let that stew for a while and come back to it in a couple of weeks and, you know, see where we are, or, you know, have you thought about taking this approach? And, you know, they are so supportive of the college, but they're also so supportive of me. And I haven't had this particular experience before over an extended period of time in terms of a board chair and vice chair, and it has made such a difference. So, you know, I tell them pretty much every phone call how much I appreciate the time that they spend with me and the college and so on. And they really were the leaders in resolving this issue about the growth of the college. They were the first two to do the, you know, to come and listen to groups of faculty. And, you know, I really think it's their leadership that got us through that particular challenge.
Yeah, Maria, we always end with this last question. It's the same question, and that is, yeah, and I'm turning the tables, and if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Well, my first question is being President Harvey Mudd your favorite job ever? And it used to be that my favorite job ever was being head of the computer science department at UBC, which was just an amazing experience. And I'm so incredibly proud of how well they have done. And, you know, it's just, they have more than, you know, surpassed my dreams. And, you know, that was incredible. But I have to say, I think being President Harvey Mudd is now really my favorite job ever. And you know, there's a long gap in between because I stopped being I stopped being head of computer science in the end of '94, and so you know it's essentially 20 years, and so it's a very big thing to say that. So I'm really happy to be able to say that. My second question is: do you have any regrets about not becoming president at a top research university? And you know, I have to say that, you know, while I was at Princeton, both I thought that would be where I went to be president, and Princeton thought that, and it's what I thought, you know, when I was a dean and a vice president at UBC as well. So it was certainly the, what my expectation was. And, you know, and I think that if that happened to have worked out, I might well be saying, you know, that that really was what I wanted to happen, because it had never occurred to me to go be president of a tiny college like Harvey Mudd. But I will say that, you know, having been a vice president and a dean at a couple of great universities, you know, at UBC and Princeton, and having, you know, spent tons of time at, you know, places like MIT and Stanford and, you know, so and so forth, Berkeley, I'm glad it worked out this way, because I think it's provided me with greater leverage and also more time to focus on things other than just my institution. Obviously, I think about Mudd all the time, but it's given me some space to focus on broader societal issues, and I'm grateful for that. So I don't have any regrets. And then my last one was, any regrets about leaving Canada 12 years ago? And, you know, it's always a mixed set of feelings. I mean, I'm born in Canada. The 15 years we spent in Vancouver were some of the best years of my life. It's where my kids grew up. It's where I got to spend time with my parents in their, you know, in their later years, which I'm deeply grateful for. And I, you know, my number one place is in the universe is Pender Island, and then after that comes Vancouver. So, you know, I loved UBC. I loved Vancouver. But I eventually, you know, decided that I had to leave if I was going to have more impact in terms of societal change, and particularly in science and engineering, the culture of science and engineering. And so, you know, on balance, the trade-off was really well worth it. I mean, I feel like I couldn't have this level of impact if I'd stayed in Canada. I still, you know, get to spend several weeks a year on Pender Island. I still visit Vancouver a couple of times a year, usually something at UBC, and you know, I'm not sure I thought I would ever get to the point where I could not have regrets. But I, at this point, I don't have regrets. And you know, it was interesting. I was talking to the chancellor at the University of Toronto after receiving an honorary doctorate in June. And I was saying, you know, Canada is a much better country than the U.S. in so many ways. And we need to figure out a way to get, to make Canada more visible, because Canada, like healthcare and the educational system, all those kinds of things, they really work so much better than what's going on in the United States. And yet the United States, they have no idea. And he said, you know, it's so funny, because we had Paul Volcker here last week for an honorary doctorate, and he said exactly the same thing about Canada's financial system. It's so much better run than the U.S. financial system. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Maria, you've taken us on a remarkable journey in sharing so much of your insights and your experiences, and especially these last few years, but really your entire career through all the interviews you've done. So I know that Nick is waiting in the background and say, when is she going to get finished that interview? And you have so many.
Oh, I told them I was going to be doing it until 11, and it is 10:59, so we did it perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, there's so much value that you always share and so many insights, and you live it and then you share it. So we are indeed fortunate that you came in and took the time, and I really do thank you.
I have a special thank you for you, Stephen. You were the first person to ever start asking me these kinds of questions, and it's been and you have become, a champion for Harvey Mudd College and for diversity in the tech industry, and somebody who's really helping us do what we're trying to do. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be sharing this journey with you, Maria, from 2005. So I just want to close and say I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the amazing Maria Clavé, pioneering, world-renowned computer scientist and executive leader.